tickets at the door of 15. Join Medea, June 19th, Hillside Club. Full info, kpfa.org.
And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 2 o'clock. Up next, the Visionary Activist Show.
Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So we convene our Dark of the Moon Council. Let us all imagine ourselves at the circular table turning into a spiral table. This is traditionally when those dedicated to guiding humans back into cahoots with nature would gather, especially this Dark of the Moon before the summer solstice. I will most likely be giving a virtual summer solstice talk on Wednesday night at the time of the summer solstice. If you want to find out more about that, info at coyotenetworknews.com. So here we are. It's the war on Venus, you know, the war on life. You know, we remember that Sarah James, our Gwich'in elder ally from the Arctic, says, you know, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And she says, don't call it ANWR because it will loosen, it will lessen our intimacy and then they'll drill more likely. But she says the Gwich'in call it the place where all life begins. Why would we be trying to kill all of life? We wonder, you know, from all of, so many of our teammates, you know, who are dedicated to preserving life in the ocean and everywhere, they go, it's a white knuckle time. You know, it's neck and neck. You know, can we humans rejoin the community of creation? So we know in the mythological realm right now, Venus, having transited the sun, you know, associated with the downfall of tyranny, we like that, and she is in the underworld, invisible. But within the next 10 days, according to our latitude, she will rise, the heliacal rise of Venus, right before the sun. And that was always thought by indigenous people as, and the indigenous part of all of us, as heralding the new Renaissance possibilities of human culture in cahoots with nature. So she's gathering her woof now, you know, and we with her, and the sign in which she will rise is Gemini, her voice back. And we go, yes. And we remember that when Venus transited the sun in the underworld, where we see what we normally don't see, that sign at which she got full kind of solar woof, its metaphor was, you know, a woman activist giving rousing speech. And we go, well, that could be the Earth herself. And then just remember what we've been working on for years, too, is the Inanna myth carries the whole Venus orbital cycle, both science and myth wedded together. And when Venus gets back from the underworld as the morning star, Inanna, she lounges around for a while, but then she becomes the trickster redeemer. And she realizes that the god of wisdom has become a tyrant. Let's underline that. Very important. Very hip of the Sumerians to think that 2,500 years ago, that any god of wisdom can easily become a tyrant. And she decides, and the tyrannical god of wisdom has stolen human culture and stolen humans' capacity to cooperate with nature and left empty, toxic celebrity baubles in its place. And so Inanna goes off and she gets the god of wisdom drunk and she takes back culture, and it's a longer story, but here's the abbreviated form. And it's the erotic arts and the kinship with nature arts, and then, you know, science and astronomy and architecture and all of that, and she puts them in her boat and sails back with her good friend to humans, and then they can have a wise, sane, reverent culture again. So myth, yes, and we vote for that. Well, let's cahoot with that. So it is more than perfect at this time that we welcome one of our favorite allies. We are welcoming Derek Jensen, fellow pragmatic mystic, prolific, fierce advocate for life and the restoration of the manners of sane, reverent common sense to our rogue species, using all of our faculties, action informed by dreams, metaphoric agility, ingenuity. And we might ponder, you know, perhaps the only gift, responsibility we have that distinguishes us humans is our capacity to borrow reverently with manners, borrow different qualities of intelligence from the flora and fauna of our Earth team, that we may dance back into nature's embrace as collaborators rather than as dominators. So we know, you know, from our allies, from Derek and from Paul Stamets, you know, nature says, let's either, and Stephen Buhner, a great botanist, nature says, let's either kill the humans, you know, viral storms and all, you know, or heal them. Let's try healing them first. So, yes, cooperators are standing by awaiting our willingness and wonder, and we go, metaphors be with you. Derek's website is Derek Jensen, J-E-N-S-E-N, .org. And tonight, you lucky beings on the West Coast, Derek Jensen, sponsored by KPFA, we'll be giving a talk, a discourse, a conversation, civilization and resistance. That will be at 7:30 p.m. tonight at King Middle School Auditorium, 1781 Rose Street, Berkeley. It's $12 in advance, brownpapertickets.com, or $15 at the door. Hey, hardly anything. Derek is the author of 15 books, including A Language Older Than Words, Endgame, and my particular favorite, I think, Dreams. Welcome, Derek. Hello, are you there?
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, good. Good. Yes, no, it is, I think, you know, our conversing, and as I said to you backstage, you know, I like defining magic as simply a willingness to cooperate with everything. So there's so many possibilities to radio and to our conversation right now, as well as the talk you'll be giving tonight, that, you know, as we journey, you know, critique and then blessing, I love your fierce standards. You know, we don't want spiritual colonialism masquerading as anything, you know, but availing ourselves of the power of dreams, the muse, the genius, we can put things on our table for our dynamic listenership to go, let's vow this, let's change this as we go. So, yes, well, here we are, you know, I mean, and you're famous for your ferocity, and, but the book Dreams is so pertinent for now. Again, dreams, vision, imagination, this realm of our mysterious intimacy with animals and plants and our capacity to imagine and have metaphor. And, you know, as we'd said backstage, and the thing that you know, the loss of animism is a sure sign of, you know, the colonized mind. So wherever you want to dive in, but let me just put one more thing here. You know, where we're in cahoots too, let the hubris of humanism be transited, by the truth of animism. And you'd said backstage going, yeah, humanism, though, you want to write a whole book on the speciesist thing. Do you want to dive in on that one?
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah, I'm actually going to write a book, a couple books down the road, about human supremacism.
Yeah.
I think that that's actually the biggest problem facing the planet today, which is the notion that humans are fundamentally separate from and superior to everyone else. And I was talking to a friend of mine the other day, who's a longtime activist, and he, you know, very deeply, he's very deeply dedicated to the natural world. And he said, well, why do you call it human supremacism instead of the more common anthropocentrism? And I think because I think human supremacism is really the same impulse as white supremacism or male supremacism. It's not just centered on humans, but it's actually the notion that we're superior and that the others don't matter, they're less than. And we were talking about this more, and, you know, all the definitions, and the first, you can't either intellectually or morally defend human supremacism or male supremacism, any of the supremacisms, but people, of course, try all the time. And the first defense is oftentimes religious, you know, males are superior because God says we are, because God's a man, and God says men are superior. And humans are superior because... In fact, I just read the letter to the editor in my local newspaper in the little tiny town where I live the other day, saying that, you know, these environmentalists are terrible because they say that salmon have equal standing with humans, but God said humans are better. And basically, that's a really fine defense because there's nothing you can say about it.
Oh, well, I can chime in on that one, because when I had Neil Douglas Klotz, a biblical scholar and all, he said the most criminal mistranslation in the Bible is when it says, and God gave humans dominion over the, you know, and he goes, that's not what it says. And in Islam and Sufi culture, they're clear on this. The actual more complex word was, God was handing out gifts, you know, and said, you know, who wants this gift of guiding creatures to their true nature, you know, being responsible stewards? And the wolves said they were busy, you know, and humans said, we'll take that, you know, what could go wrong? But what was given was not dominance, but the responsibility to steward and encourage all beings to their true nature. That might even be a little too colonial, but it's much better, you know. And so it's a mistranslation. Okay, so yeah, let's compost that.
Yeah, let's compost that. So that's one definition. The second argument for some sorts of supremacism is oftentimes honestly science. And there's some really fascinating reading from the 1830s about why it's okay for white people to enslave Africans. And there were lots of scientific reasons given, one of which, just as always, still really stuck with me, is that the scientists said that the distance between an African male's penis and his belly button was less than that of a white person, which means it's okay to enslave them. I mean, it's just, of course, we see this for what it is when it comes to that, but when it comes to non-humans, it's still, so the point I'm getting at is all the definitions of why humans are superior all end up being tautological, by which I mean humans define some characteristic as superior, and they use a human characteristic to define that which must make someone superior, and then humans are the ones who, surprisingly enough, end up being superior by the definition. But I've been thinking about this in terms of a whole bunch of things, and one of the things I've been thinking about that just kind of makes me laugh is, okay, let's come up with a plan to get food all through the winter, so you're not hungry in the winter, and then in the spring, and you want to do so in a way that makes it so you actually improve things for your future generations. So which is a better idea? Gathering a bunch of nuts and scattering them all over the place and then forgetting a bunch of them to raise future trees, or agriculture? You know, I'm comparing squirrels and humans. And frankly, squirrels have a much better idea for how to survive the winter. It's much smarter, frankly, to do the squirrel idea than it is to plow up the soil and then make storehouses and do it that way. Anyway, the point is that human supremacism is a real problem, and human separatism. But to go back to the whole notion of the Book of Dreams, you know, I was gonna write a book. Basically, dreams have always been very important to me, and I wanted to write a book about the importance of dreams, and I always kept putting it off because, as you know, with the world being murdered, there's just not time to actually. I mean, why would I write a book about dreams? That seems kind of, you know, a trivial topic, and I'm being, you know, trivial as being ironic there, because at first it did seem trivial, but then the more I thought about it, the more that wasn't right, because, you know, I've said so many times before, and so many indigenous people have said, that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerners perceive listening to the natural world as a metaphor, as opposed to the way the world really works. That indigenous peoples would generally perceive the world as consisting of other beings to enter into relationship with, so trees have something to say. But there's another difference too, which is that traditionally dreams have been extremely important to how we conduct our lives. It's not just random firings of neurons. And instead they've been crucial to helping us determine how we live our lives individually and collectively. And so what I wanted to write about is how much we are costing the world and ourselves by refusing to listen to messages from what, for lack of a better term, I call in the book the other sides. And that would be dreams, that would be muses, visions. And you know, it's pretty interesting. I was listening to a YouTube talk by I don't remember her name, the Eat, Pray, Love person.
Yeah. Oh, that's right, about genius.
Yeah. It was pretty fascinating where she was saying, and this perfectly fits with what I've been thinking forever. You know, I've been writing for years, I've been thanking the muse in my books, and I never I've taken some crap for that over the years, that people say, oh my gosh, you know, he says we should stop civilization because trees tell him that, or, you know, he listens to a muse. And I found it really validating for her to say that until the Enlightenment, which is not the greatest piece of propaganda ever to call the rise of science the Enlightenment, but anyway, until the Enlightenment, all artists recognized they had muses. And it wasn't a question of us writing things in our lonely little self, but we actually listened to some being greater than us. And so the book starts off really with that recognition that there are these other allies on other sides, and probably enemies on other sides too, and that there are beings on other sides, and there's probably some who don't care about us either way. You know, there's all these independent beings. Independence is the wrong word. There are all these others is really the right word, and they're worth listening to, and they're worth respecting or being scared of or being in love with, or, you know, just like anybody else. And we've cut ourselves off from that systematically. There's something I'm going to jump to the end of the book here, and then I'll be quiet, and you can just ask or comment.
whatever, yes.
But there's something from the end of the book that really struck me. An indigenous friend of mine, Wazia Tawin, she's a Dakota woman. We were talking about the book, and she told me about another indigenous person whose book she used in her classes, and it led to this whole conversation about how among indigenous peoples, traditionally, the notion of non-consensual reality would be something that would be expected in your lifetime. And what is meant by non-consensual reality is that if the three of us are sitting in a room or sitting in a forest or whatever, and one of us all of a sudden sees a deer that the other two people don't see, in Western culture, it would generally be guessed that the one person is either mistaken or crazy. But that those experiences would be an expected part of everyday life, which doesn't mean that people still can't be crazy and people still can't make stuff up and people can't confabulate and people can't project. It doesn't mean any of that. But it means that there are these moments where the fabric of what we call reality.
A child abduction occurred on June 14th at 11 a.m. in Santa Rosa, California. The first child's name is Eliana Rojo, a 7-year-old Hispanic female. Second child's name is Maria Rojo, a 6-year-old Hispanic female. And the third child is Sofia Rojo, a 3-year-old female. The suspect is Jose Albert Rojo Borjorquez, a 25-year-old Hispanic male, possibly driving a 2005 black Chevrolet Tahoe, California license plate number 6TXA253. To report possible sightings, call 911.
Completely. The next thing I was going to say is that another thing I was pretty excited about in a realization through the book is that I think monotheism is one of the biggest mistakes that humans have ever made. That's not the realization yet. That's old news.
Yeah.
And there was I was talking to a friend of mine through the middle of the book who said that, you know, monotheism really did the heavy lifting for a mechanistic science, in that one of the things that monotheism did is it, you know, if you have a distant sky god, what you've done is you've removed divinity from the earth and from all of our, you know, divinity from being everywhere around us. You've removed meaning, really, from all around us. You put it on this little receptacle way, way out in the sky that nobody can ever see. And then science is just sort of the next logical step of, you know, turning out that final light. Once you've removed meaning from the plants, the soil, yourself, and all those around you, then it's really not a big deal to take that next step and remove meaning from the earth whatsoever, or remove meaning from all life. And once you remove meaning from all life, and once again, this is not original to me at all, you paved the way for
yeah.
paving the world.
Yes.
Because if the world is meaningless, who cares if you destroy the oceans? I mean, it really is nothing but short-term, I don't even want to say short-term gratification, because it ends up really short-term spectacle. I'm going to jump a different direction here for a second. And there was this really interesting book I read back in the 1980s, 1990s, and Band Played On by Randy Schiltz. It was about the early days of the AIDS crisis. And one of the things that he talked about was, and he was a participant in this, so he was talking about it really from the inside. One of the things he talked about was the bathhouse culture. And one of the things he was saying is that if you remove relationship, you know, some of the stuff that happened in the bathhouses was really, really extreme. And we're talking about some extreme anonymous sex. And one of the things he said is if you remove relationship from sexuality, if you keep relationship in sexuality, some relationship whatsoever, then because beings are infinitely complex, you can continue to, it never really gets boring because you're always still exploring. But if you remove relationship entirely, you have to get that sensation of excitement from somewhere else. And so you have to keep upping the sort of physical ante in terms of stimulation.
Right.
And I take this back to what we just said about science, monotheism, and then science removing meaning from the world. But if the world's essentially meaningless, and you aren't in all of these incredibly complex relationships and this incredibly complex dance, you have to keep sort of upping the physical stakes in order to not get bored. So what we've done really is exchange relationship for just increasing spectacle. That's why I don't want to say it's not even selfishness, because the selfish thing would be to actually be living in a fulfilled and happy way. But that's not what this is going. It's just increasing, I'm just going to keep using the cliche. It's just increasing spectacle.
Well, yeah, and I want to sort of converse on this one too, because, you know, in the beautiful language of astrology, you know, again, everything, we're saying that right now there's a hyper yang Mars, a kind of compensatory hyper yang Mars, because I like to say all tyranny is compensatory weenydom, intrinsic, you know. But along what you're saying, a monotheism is a big mistake in the mechanistic science, and which is kinned to even some of our team who, in an abstract and distant way, say, well, even if we destroy this planet, life will continue on in other ways. And it's like, yes, but we have kinship for every moist-eyed being and every, you know, even bacteria, whatever. And so, you know, we're here now. And along what you're saying, wonderful archaeologist, psychologist, ally of mine, Robinette Kennedy, famous for saying, what if the idea of matriarchy is a patriarchal concept, which is fun. But she says, what about actual equality? But she says, if we go back far enough, you know, the moment humans had a word for the divine, we were out of the garden. Because then it was no longer imminent in the rocks and ourselves, you know, all in this pulsing dream together. So even the word, you know, and I go, ooh, this is good. And the other thing I just want to put on our table, and bounce back to you, is she said, you know, the modern concept of worship and all the different sneaky forms of spiritual colonialism, she said it's very hierarchical. It's like, oh, you are great, I am nothing, now give me this thing. And she said in ancient, also Mediterranean culture, but also indigenous culture, she said the relationship between the invisible and the visible was full of respect, but it was much more collaborative. She said the invisible seeks incarnation, fur, mangoes, flesh, you know, as much as we seek kinship with it. And I go, this is really crucial. As long as we have a hierarchical science or religion, we're going to get Dick Cheney. And this idea of collaborating, and if we go far enough back, you know, which lives in our bones and our blood, you know, this kinship model that we live in a conversational storytelling creation, that everything's telling us its story and it's by its shape, its color, its song, its dream. So if we just approach the world with informed, reverent curiosity, you know, we get to be back in the garden. So
once again, I completely agree. And there's two things I'm thinking. One of them is that it's really clear to me that in our relationship, in my relationship with my particular muse, she needs me as much as I need her.
There you go.
And she is working just as urgently as I am. And, you know, she may need me for just simply because I have opposable thumbs, you know? Actually, part of the reason she needs me is because I have a body. And
yeah.
There are things that she can't do.
Right, you're incarnate.
And, yeah, and she, and then there are things that, that she can do for me. And we work. See, the, it's, I've never understood the whole notion of, I mean, I understand that there are times to be in opposition, but there are also times, I mean, I've never understood, like, man versus woman, or human versus non-human, or salmon versus non-salmon. It doesn't make any sense to me. That makes no sense to me whatsoever in general. I understand that if somebody's trying to beat you up, you can fight them back. And, you know, it's right now, it's me versus you because you're trying to hit me with a baseball bat. But also, I don't understand. It's like, it's not me versus the muse. I mean, we complement each other, just like the salmon and the grizzly bears and the humans and the otters. They all complement each other. That just seems so incredibly self-evident to me. That was one thing I was going to say. And the other thing I've forgotten.
Well, but that's really chewy and worthwhile, and we really want to honor exactly what you just said, which is perfect, because you know if it is time, you know, it is perfect that we as humans cannot solve the innumerable irreverent crises we've inflicted on our kin by ourselves. It's by ourselves that got us into this pickle. So if we're going to derive, I mean, I like saying all natural facts are social strategy metaphors. You know, how do we spiral back into cahoots? And in nature, whenever conflicting forces, you know, meet, spirals. And so spirals, you know, in many ways, you know, linguistic spiraling, you know, energetic spiraling, Aikido spiraling, hurricanes, galaxies, you know. So to cultivate and tease the implications of this into our spiraling. And then even, you know, I had a guest on radio who was a specialist in predator-prey relationship. And he said there's manners everywhere, even in predator-prey. And I love that he said the hawk and the prairie dog. And if the prairie dog's close enough to its little hole to escape, it makes a little eyebrow signal to the hawk going, don't even bother, you'll waste your energy. And the hawk goes, you know, thank you. You know, I mean, there's manners, and I think we want to put this on our work table, that manners are not some mismanners enforced social code of arbitrary constraint. It's intrinsic, you know, to nature. This, we have only so much water. We have only so much temperature thing. These are manners. Wolves are incredibly mannered, you know, a disciplined wildness. Nature's incredibly disciplined and structured in its wildness. So to tease these principles, so what I've been working with is if we have an affinity, like wolves, water, whatever we love and want to be its agent, you know, then become more like a wolf, become more like water. There's biomimicry, right? Which is, you know, our great ally Janine Benyus says, you know, rather than looting nature, why don't we borrow her recipes? And so what I'm really dedicated to is, how about mythological biomimicry? You know, now we get into your fabulous realm and your fabulous book Dreams, you know, which is, you know, may we, you know, always with manners, you know, may we borrow some models of leadership from the wolves. May we draw upon, you know, I don't know if you've heard Paul Stamets's story about the incredible ingenuity of the slime mold designing the designing the Tokyo subway system, going, are we humble enough and wise enough, you know, to cooperate with the design ingenuity of slime mold? You know, can we be like little humans in a Chinese landscape painting again, going, big nature, little teeny human down in the valley, that kind of deal. And what I want to pitch to you and all of us in our work is, whatever we Venus, whatever we invite in another person is what we're drawing forth into the dance, you know. It's like when the Yes Men, disguised as WTO people, went to the International Convention of Accountants, and they came out and they said, we're grossed out on greed. We've had a big change of heart. You know, we want to really do good for the planet. You know, and all the accountants were like, yes, we want to be good people too. And it was revealed as a hoax, but it was a hoax that actually drew out the secret goodness of people. You know, so how about that?
Well, I like it, and I'm also thinking about what I loved what you said about manners a little while ago, and about learning from the wolves. And I think another thing that's really important is to not pornography that relationship such that I think it's important to ask the wolves, is it okay to borrow this bit of leadership? And if they say no, then you say, okay.
Yeah.
That there always has to be that consent. And I'm also thinking about manners. I don't know if I ever told you this story, but I love this story. Years ago, I was sitting next to a pond with two dogs and three cats, all of whom are now dead. But at the time, they weren't. And there was a rat came walking up to us, and the dog started to chase it, and I called them back, and the rat swam across the pond and got out. And when I saw when it got out that it could barely walk, and I realized suddenly that I had just done a terrible thing, because the rat was, I think, really sick and had screwed up its courage. I mean, why would a rat walk up to two dogs, three cats, and a big ape? They're not going to do that unless they're saying, you know, I'm actually really sick and I'm in pain and I want to end it. And it was going to be an act of assisted suicide. And I interrupted that, and the rat's like, oh, man, now I have to go find somebody else. and I think the...
CHP has issued a child abduction alert for three children kidnapped in Santa Rosa this morning. Police say it happened about 11 this morning. The suspect is 25-year-old Jose Albert Rojo Borquez. He is a Hispanic male, 5'7" tall, with black hair and brown eyes. He is suspected of abducting 7-year-old Alina Rojo, 6-year-old Mariah Rojo, and 3-year-old Sofia Rojo. All three are Hispanic. The suspect was last seen driving a black Chevrolet Tahoe with California license plate of 6TXA253. Once again, that's 6TXA253. This concludes the activation of the emergency alert system.
Something you believe in. A religion is what you do every moment.
Yes.
And so he said the religion of somebody who goes to church on Saturday and then spends the rest of the week making money, or Sunday, you know, whatever. I grew up a Seventh-day Adventist, so why I said that. Anyway, somebody going to church on Saturday or Sunday and then they spend the rest of the day, rest of the week making money, their religion is making money.
Exactly. And we've been having so much fun, I let the break go by us. Okay, we're going to have a very short 10-20-30-second break, and we'll be right back with Derek Jensen, derekjensen.org. Here's our break music coming, and we will be right back. Hold that thought, Derek.
She shook the constellation that dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellation that dazzled them across his eyes. She showered his head with quasar and made his tosses cry.
Get down.
Shiny, 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 come blow my shiny home. Ooh, shiny, 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 come blow my shiny home. Telegraph my indigo sky ship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, giving a virtual summer solstice talk next Wednesday. Go to info@coyotenetworknews.com for more of that. But our guest, our fantabulous guest, such a crucial contributing to conversing, con with versing, turning, we're all in a giant conversation tonight. Derek Jensen, our guest right now, will be your Kahooter. Derek Jensen is giving a talk, a conversation on civilization and resistance at 7:30 p.m. That is tonight. It is sponsored by KPFA. Yay, good Kahooting, good collaboration. At the King Middle School Auditorium, 1781 Rose Street, Berkeley. $12 advance tickets. There's still time at brownpapertickets.com or $15 at the door. No problem. So fill that hall, because this is a worthy, good conversing that we want, that is Derek and KPFA in cahoots. Fabulous. So, yeah, Derek, right where you were was, yes, the truth of what we worship is what we spend our time on. Yes, exactly. They're,
so the religion of this culture is pavement, or, you know, whatever.
Well, whatever. I mean, and let's you know, as you said, you know, in other words, but we're so kinned in some ways, you know, let's not impose constraining certainty on liberating mystery. You know, we wonder, because wonder really opens the doors to dreams and metaphor. And even the rat story you were just saying, we go, well, I wonder if I had intervened, although it was your nature too. You know, but it is, I did, you know, I had a wonderful late great Wolfie dog, Captain Moondog Wolfie, wonderful. I still have Stella Coyote. Yes, we were in the woods and there was a sick deer and he, started to take it down, and it made a terrible sound, you know, and there were all these people on the other side of the canal going, oh my God, it's so horrible. Anyway, so I finally pulled him back, and I was like, I know this is confusing, Wolf Dog. I know this is very confusing. You're doing your job. And he's like, what? What's the deal? But anyway, this clearly kind of Republican guy ran up to me going, that's the most horrific thing I've ever seen. That's just horrible. Call the ranger. You know, I go, well, he's doing his job, you know. And I go, and I just said, so I guess you're, you know, against war, right? And he's like, okay. Anyway, so yes, these modern etiquette confusions. But I did want to bring up, you know, that all of nature is so kind to us. Oh my God, you know. So we've put landmines everywhere, and what humans have found in Africa and now in South America, because the drug gangs have put mines everywhere too, is that rats are really good mine detectors. And so it's wonderful, from being reviled in African villages, now each family, you know, has their own rat that they love, and the rat loves them. But what they found in South America is the rats doing their job, very kind of them, to bail us out. But they were vulnerable to predators. And so they raised rats and cats together. So each rat had a cat who was literally watching its back. And the rat would go out to find the mines, and the cat would go out as its team to keep it safe. I just, you know, it's just very moving.
I love that.
Yeah.
So I was thinking during the break, if it's okay, I would like to ask you a question, because there's something that's been kind of confusing me, and it seems like you're the perfect person to ask. And that's, when I was in my 20s, I went to a fair number of rock concerts, and I liked the music, but I wasn't sure about some of those circumstances, and we'll leave that aside for a second. Then I read Lewis Mumford, and Lewis Mumford was very down on rock concerts as being sort of bacchanalian in a negative sense, not in a prudish sense, but just in a somehow negative sense. And I didn't really, when I was reading Myth of the Machine, I didn't really agree with him so much, but I've been looking at some YouTube videos of rock concerts sometimes, over the past year or something. And sometimes I'll see, like there was one specifically, it was AC/DC's Highway to Hell, and it was this huge audience. And the audience is pulsing in mass as they're saying, I'm on the highway to hell. And I found it really disturbing. And it's feeling, I want to raise the word toxic mimic.
Yes.
Well, I'm wondering if you can tell me why I find this disturbing and what Lewis Mumford's talking about. Do you
No, I'm completely up for this. Because it is something to bring before our council. How do we gather? And one of the things I think we want to put on our table for all of us now to go, yes, you know, is our manner of relating individually or as a species an offering? Or an imposition? Does it serve empire and dominance, which is collapsing, or collaborative, you know, cooperate with everything, reverent ingenuity coming up? And it's a big theme for me, because I was also presenting at a big music festival in Costa Rica. It was 1,500 people in the jungle, and there was some great beauty, but the word cacophony also arose, because there were, like, you know, five electronic bands at full volume, and I go, I don't think the monkeys are up for this. I don't think this is reverent. It's an interesting conundrum. There's a great book you might want to track down, out of print, but you're a good tracker, called The Death and Resurrection Show by it'll come to me. I know the name. But anyway, a British guy, Rogan Taylor. And he goes back, like, what is the origin of theater? What's the origin of theater? As far back as you can go, and we keep going further back, and he goes, it was always to invite power into the human community to animate the desirable story. There was always something powerful supposed to happen. And he tracks it through Greek mystery plays and African, you know, juju rituals, and I mean, everything all the way up into rock and roll. And he says, the Death and Resurrection Show is a great title because he said it was always for something powerful to happen, but because in the modern world, with movies and explosions and loud volume and bad sound systems, people go even to movies with the kind of the innocent dignity of their child heart, knowing that something profound is supposed to happen, but it doesn't. And so the modern world's, you know, toxic mimic response is, well, it didn't. It's like what you were just saying. So let's make it louder. It's like pornography without intimacy. Let's make it louder as a compensation for the crucial missing ingredient, which was that it was, again, we don't source power. We invite it, and gathering and language and making things beautiful is a way of inviting the invisible into the world. You know, this, again, manners, you know. So, yes, we could go on that one. But yeah, I'm really up for that because it's like the impulse. We want to cook everything back to its original, intimate, collaborative, offering impulse and re-express it. But we do want to put these principles on the table, you know, because, you know, how do we gather? And is it respectful? Is it an offering? Is it for all beings? You know, and otherwise, you know, let's throw it back into the cauldron.
Well, thank you so much. That helps me understand. I want to ask one more question just to sort of, to use a terrible metaphor, nail this down.
Oh, yeah. No. Okay.
And it's the same with sporting events. You know, I actually like sports. I like watching sports, but it's weird for me to see, especially when the world's being killed, to see 50,000 people, you know, pulsing as one over this. And I think part of it isn't part of it all. Okay. So the attraction, I mean, isn't there, I'm thinking also of something I wrote in Dreams that, and this wasn't all an excuse to get to this, but it does fit in.
Yeah.
But toward the end, I talk about this woman, Felicitas Goodman.
Oh, yeah, I know her. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and I love the stuff in there about how she says we are ecstasy deprived.
Oh, yes.
And how she believes that that's part of the reason that we go to, that there's so much addiction of all sorts, is that, and then she has that wonderful stuff about how a lot of those figurines, a lot of the paintings are actually instructions on how, on positions that you should assume to induce certain forms of trance.
Yes, I've done this.
So I'm wondering, and I have too, it's absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering if the mass sporting events or the mass concerts are then toxic mimics of the rituals and trance inducement that is supposed to be an everyday part of our life in a community. And as you said, that calling of the power. And so is this all making sense?
Completely. No, completely. No, you're more than making sense. Because my friend Robinette Kennedy that I just quoted was Felicitas Goodman's student. So we're going, oh, we're connecting here. Because I think as aspiring cultural alchemists, you know, we look at everything and rather than go, we go, what did this want to be before it got toxic and before it deviated? What did it want to be? So, no, I think you're, we do want this inquiry and we do want this wonder. We wonder what this wanted to be. But yeah, the work of Felicitas Goodman, you know, interesting, crazy ass German woman. She did notice that around the world there were shamanic statues that were similar of body postures. So she put graduate students to hold these postures in a light trance with drumming. And, they are, as you know, and I know from work, they are objective. I mean, the kingdom of heaven really is at hand. We have so many things like Dorothy's slippers in The Wizard of Oz. We have so much capacity for ecstatic trance intimacy built in, but we have been, the reality police has distracted and fed the empty toxic mimics, you know. But yeah, no, ecstatic self-loss, what a good idea. You know, and we might say all war is a failure of imagination, and so is pornography a failure of imagination. But the anarchists used to say, you know, what did pornography want to be before it got toxic? It wanted to be a perfectly pure desire for eros and exoticism before it got kidnapped into obedience to empire. You know, and the sporting thing is, well, you know, I just for some reason I also want to bring in, you know, all of our animal friends. There was a great National Geographic film on animals at play, and there's just nothing that moves our human hearts more, really, than, and there was this great example of this, you know, kind of highly dominant monkey group. I think it was chimpanzees, can't remember. But there was the lowest guy. He ate last, he was disrespected, he was beat up, until one day he found a garbage can lid. And she's got this on film. And then he found a stick. And he began to beat the stick against the garbage can lid. And you can see him going up and downhill, beating the stick on the garbage can lid. And all the other monkeys who'd been oppressing him looked and were like, wow. And then they made him the leader. Isn't that great?
Yeah, and it also reminds me of something that John Livingston said that I really liked. And this helped me. He was the first person to help me understand that natural selection really isn't based on competition, but rather cooperation.
Yes, yes.
And I was saying, well, what about all those fights between, you know, bighorn sheep? And he just looked at me and he said, fights? They're playing games.
Uh-huh.
I mean, how is that any different than playing lacrosse or football or soccer? They're having fun, you know, and it's not really... They're not fighting. They're not trying to conquer each other. It's a sport. And that was one of those moments that everything turned around for me.
Yes. And there are rules, you know, I mean, again, there's rules, which is why, you know, in South Africa, there was a bunch of young sort of teenage male elephants who were behaving badly. They were beating animals up, right, and keeping them away from the waterhole. And they were going to kill them, and until one guy said, well, wait a minute, we called all their elders, so they don't have any manners or respect, you know. And so they brought in these larger, older elephants who were like, no, you do not do that, you do just, and just kind of, whoa, okay. But yes, and Kropotkin, you know, and all the, yes, that we evolve mutual aid, reciprocal symbiosis. And our word compete, see, again, in the same way, you know, our love of language, if we look words up in a dictionary, it also takes us back to animism, to etymological aliveness. The word compete means to strive together. That's what it actually means. You know, the word inaugurate was the augur, the diviner, who would walk out into nature, and by nature's patterns, nature would reveal who the responsible human steward is, and then they would be inaugurated. You know, it takes us back to this living... Anyway, language, metaphor, I think are those things that lead us, are meant to lead us to kinship, hence poetry and ecstatic self-loss. And then we get to, I can't remember if you mentioned this, you know, but if we're returning from the exile of intimacy, you know, back into ecstatic self-loss, which is like when we're leaping through a wave, it's like we're not watching ourselves, we're not, you know, we're just, oh! And then we get to the realm of entheogens, you know, the sacramental plants that often grow where humans have disturbed nature, as though nature's going, here, eat this thing. I don't know if you love psilocybe mushrooms. Do you love psilocybe mushrooms?
Love what sort of mushrooms?
So the psilocybin mushrooms.
Oh, well, two things about that. One, I've never tried them, and the other is, oddly enough, and actually interestingly enough, I found out what my... Years ago, I went to a homeopathic doctor,
mm-hmm,
who said that my fundamental homeopathic remedy is psilocybin,
uh-huh,
which actually makes perfect sense, because one reason I've never done many drugs is because I don't really need to.
Right.
I've never done any drugs, actually. I'm sort of naturally over there anyway.
Yeah. No, fair enough. I mean, I think it is remedial. I'm a big fan of the entheogens, the whole plant systems, because it is, again, like, it seems to increase intimate perception of reality rather than mask it. You know, I mean, again, in our words, the word illusion in ludo means in the game, and the word delusion is out of the game, you know. So it increases our, you know, positive illusion and intimacy with things, and maybe you don't need that, but which is great. But I do think that that is part of the indigenous function of entheogens as a healing remedy for ecstasy, like, oh, it is so fabulous, which is available, and kinship and pattern perception. And, you know, NIMH did a study on low doses of psilocybin mushrooms, which Terence McKenna was sure, you know, and who knows, that they were part of human evolution, because it actually, in the NIMH study, it increased perception of reality. You know, they did one of these tedious things of, tell us when these lines go out of parallel into whatever, and the people on psilocybin mushrooms were like 100 times faster, like, boom. And so Terence was saying, you know, if you run across something and you're eating everything, you know, that in low doses is erotic and also increases your perception of pattern, you know, making you a better hunter, you know, this is going to be an ally. So I've always liked that. But also the model that there is a presiding invisible intelligence behind the plant entheogens, and they do have manners. I mean, they require manners. I mean, people who approach anything, including the plants, you know, with kind of like, that is rude. You know, so you know, in our kahooting, which I guess you will be carrying on later tonight, let me just announce this again to people, you lucky humans out in Berkeley, San Francisco area, because Derek Jensen will be presenting tonight in Conversing, a KPFA-sponsored event. Tonight, Derek Jensen, Civilization and Resistance. Let's come back and talk about that word. 7:30 p.m. at King Middle School Auditorium, 1781 Rose Street, Berkeley. $12 in advance, brownpapertickets.com, or $15 at the door. Hey, why not? It's good for everybody. Let's see, we were talking about, you can jump in. This is Democrat. You can jump in anywhere you want to, Derek. But
well, I was thinking, you know, I was just thinking about what you're saying about the mushrooms, that and about the evolution with humans, and of course I think that this is true for everyone. You know, forests evolved with salmon, and salmon evolved with forest. And if you remove the salmon from the forest, it's not really a forest anymore.
And humans evolved with wolves. I mean, we'd be nothing without them.
Yep. And the one having to do that I actually know the most about, and this won't surprise you, but I live in Northern California, or since I live in Northern California, the one I'm most familiar with actually is our relationship with marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And I have Crohn's disease, and living in Northern California, I take it, you know, completely legally. And it's just, it stuns me. You know, I actually didn't think about it much until a few years ago. And it is so useful for Crohn's disease, and
yeah.
It's so useful for so many. Useful is not the word I really want to use here, but it is so beneficial, I guess, that it's just so clear to me that we have this, well, okay, it ends up that it's very beneficial for a lot of diseases. But even before that, just when I never encountered the plant, I never used any of it until very recently, you know, 5-6 years. But the thing I want to point out is that when I first saw plants, when I first saw marijuana plants, I fell in love with them immediately.
They're beautiful.
It's not, I mean, and I think, okay, what I've been thinking about this, and I wrote about this some in Dreams, what I've been thinking about this is that I think because we have such a long relationship with them, that it is easier for us to perceive when they speak. Just like, you know, I can tell, you know, I've known my mom for all of my 52 years, and so I can tell her moods better than I can tell the mood of someone I don't know. But I don't think that marijuana plants are specifically, and the same would be true for the mushrooms, I believe, I don't think that that means that they are specifically louder than any other plants. I think it's just that we have a longer relationship, and so it's easier for us to perceive when they speak.
But it's actually a biological relationship. I had great guest Clint Werner on with his book, Marijuana, Gateway to Health. A great book. Shout out to Clint. But he explained, as so many cannabis people are explaining, in our bodies, we have cannabinol receptors. Receptors. Yep. But this biophilia, I mean, our body can manufacture it, but it prefers the kinship with the plant. This is part of the war on Venus, the war on kinship, the war on ecstasy, you know, that we would criminalize this. And it's very adorable that you go, no entheogens, but I'm crazy about cannabis. And it's like, oh, whatever, Derek. But yes, they are kinned, you know, and it's true. Our relationship to cannabis, to marijuana is very, very old. You know, it's older than even wolves. And then cats are very recent, 20,000 years of cats, 100,000 years of dogs and wolves. But cannabis, older than 100,000 years, it's been an ally, you know, a crucial thing. That's great. It is, and again, the healing of what's been falsely estranged, you know, and so when people are, you know, seeking kinship, they can disrespectfully, you know, over-abuse it, or just lack manners. We're just, you know, concerned citizens for the restoration of intrinsic natural manners in our species.
I love that you keep saying manners, because I think about that where, okay, so I live on second growth forest, and when I first moved in there, it was really clear to me that the forest itself didn't hate me, but basically it didn't really like me either. I was basically, you know, a nice enough Nazi. You know, I'm still part of the enemy. See, here's one of the things I think is really important. It is not the job of any member of any oppressed class to differentiate among the oppressors. It's the oppressor's responsibility to differentiate themselves. So it's not a woman's responsibility to differentiate me from other men. It's my responsibility to differentiate myself from other men.
Although I want to bring up something spicy, but keep going.
Okay. So anyway, I was there in a forest and living there for a few years, and the forest is still tolerating me, but not particularly liking me. I can feel it. And then I found some guy cutting off parts of redwood trees on the land where I live, and I kicked him off 3 days in a row, and he mm-hmm. finally got the message and left. And that was the moment that things changed. And it wasn't, one reason I know that this was not just internal, I shouldn't use the word just, but one reason I know that this was, I hate the word objective, but I'm going to use it, that this was, here's what I'm going to say.
Real.
One of the reasons I know this was coming from the force instead of projecting on my part is that, after I kicked the guy off, in the next 3 days, I saw the biggest red-legged frog I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw a huge pile of bear poop, which was a big deal at that point, but now I see bear poop every day. And then the third day, and this is what finally pushed me over the edge, a songbird flew out of the bushes and brushed my chest with its wing.
Yes.
And ever since then, I felt like I'm part of the land. So basically, the land said to me, it's like, oh, okay, you actually did protect us. You know?
Right.
Okay, it wasn't just rhetoric. You actually do like us. And we're now collaborating, and we're both working together to be whatever we're supposed to be. And I always think that manners are just so... We don't ask before we even put a blanket down, you know.
Since we're almost on our way out, let's invite people going. Let's ask before we put a blanket down. Let's ask before we take oil out of the earth. Let's ask: is this okay? Yes.
It's the exact same thing. It's the exact same thing. I mean, this is part and parcel of patriarchy and of rape culture. You know?
Yes.
It's the exact same thing. I mean, let's ask. Let's actually pay attention, and not even yes, ask. But in addition, does the other person want us to be near? Does the forest actually want us here? There are some parts, the land where I live, there are some parts I don't go because because I think it just needs to rest. And
yeah.
It feels like it needs to rest. And so let's just ask and then listen. Most importantly is listen and respect.
That's right. Like the Chilean miners said, you know, the mountain was speaking to us for years before, you know, we didn't listen. We go, oh, well, there's a million things we want to keep talking about, Derek. This is really great. Thank you so much. Because I want to bring up, yes, the oppressor actually seeks the medicine of what he oppresses. But that's a whole other show. Maybe we have that. Derek Jensen is speaking tonight in cahoots with KPFA, 7:30 p.m., King Middle School Auditorium, 1781 Rose Street, Berkeley, $15 at the door. Thank you so much, Erica Bridgman, in Berkeley. Thank you much, Andrew Chadwick in D.C. I'm Caroline Casey, CoyoteNetworkNews.com. Thank you a lot, Derek.
Thank you.
Okay, woof, woof.
invited to an intimate Brett Denon benefit concert on Saturday, June 16th, 3 to 5 p.m. in the backyard of a Piedmont Julia Morgan mansion. The concert and accompanying auction benefits the Mosaic Project. The Mosaic Project is an Oakland-based organization that works towards a peaceful future by reaching children in their formative years, creating relationships across lines of difference, and fostering empathy and understanding. Mosaic does this through its transformational outdoor school, youth leadership project, and in-school programs. Tickets are $100, with VIP tickets available to meet Brett personally. More information and tickets are available online at www.mosaicproject.org/BrettConcert2012 or by calling 510-452-3377.